to Uncharted and Eclectic. So great to have you here.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I am absolutely thrilled to join you today.
Yeah, we're very fortunate and lucky to have you. So, Tammy, a little birdie told me you played tennis growing up. So, typically what we love to ask with the first question is if you want to give your baseball, softball, football card, but in your case, like, do you mind giving us like your tennis card about where you grew up, how you got to where you are today?
Yes, absolutely. More than happy to do so. I was born and raised in Johannesburg, South Africa, at a tiny little town called Benoni. No one goes there, no one leaves. And I grew up playing tennis quite professionally, more competitively in that sense, played a lot of junior tournaments. And I remember that growing up, that I was adamant that I would play professionally in the US. And so I would stand every evening on the edge of my bed and sing the Star Spangled Banner because I had to be prepared to come to the US. And I, in between, when I couldn't go to the courts for practice or play, I would hit the tennis ball against the garage door in my parents' driveway. And I would set up, and in between that, I knew that if my parents weren't going to send me to America to play tennis, I would need to get myself there. And so I set up a little table in the driveway with a boombox, and I only had one cassette tape, and it was a Michael Jackson cassette tape, his Bad album. And I, in between hitting balls and sequences, I would see people walking past, and I would corral them in. I'd call them in and say, hey, you've got to listen to a song. And I would charge them. To listen to a song. I would charge them 50 cents if they wanted to listen and a dollar if they wanted to, you know, dance or sing along. And this was good. This was my hustle to get me to America to play tennis. I was 12 years old. Needless to say, I ran out of songs and I ran out of people walking by. And I played competitively different tournaments, both in South Africa and abroad. And there's a point at which you reach 5'2" and you're just not going pro when you're 16. So I had the opportunity to play in college at the Division I school in Kentucky, believe it or not. That's a culture shock from Joburg to Kentucky. But played Division I for 4 years, and that's what got me to the U.S. It's my coming to America story.
I love it. Everybody has their own unique story, including myself, but I would say yours is a little more interesting and has a little more flavor. So thanks for sharing. What do you think tennis was what has shaped you the most? Like, what's the impact, you think? Like, what are some ways it's impacted and it's influenced you to become the person you are today? It's such a big part of who you are. So,
yeah, you know, tennis was such a huge part of my identity growing up. That's what I was known for, and that's who I was. I was okay tennis. That's where you could find me. That's what I spoke about. That's what I really enjoyed. And I'm not so sure that it is who I. It's not who I am today. Most people don't even know that I played tennis growing up. And what I think is interesting is that the dedication around it, the commitment, the hustle, those are all things that you have within you that you can't necessarily buy or pick up later on in life or just choose from your toolbox so that you want to pick up this week or next week or whatever it may be. But I think it's definitely that commitment to bettering myself day in and day out, but also the struggle, the fight. And it's always been that intrinsic motivation that I've had on the tennis court that I think I've carried through in my day to day, that it's, listen, I don't necessarily need someone to light a fire underneath me to get something done, but it's within me. And I think that does come from that desire to win, that desire to keep going and fight back. That I found through sports early on in my life. And I'm really appreciative for that. I'm really thankful for having that drive. Tennis is both an individual sport when you play in singles, but also a team sport in college at the collegiate level. So I learned from going from, say, an individual contributor as a singles player to being a team player, and the team dynamics really taught me so much at the collegiate level to what business is like and having a team and operating as a team in business.
Yeah, it's a fair, you actually answered the question I had, which is like, how does the team aspect come from? Because it's a lot more obvious, right, when you're playing basketball or soccer or football, but the observations, at least in your story that called out, is the process it takes, the amount of hours that like it takes into perfecting your craft, in this case tennis, like behind the scenes. I can't imagine how many hours you had to spend like growing up. So thanks for sharing at least how it's kind of influenced you. So what did you do after? Like you went to, you had a really good career in tennis. You went to college for it. What happened afterwards?
I was absolutely burnt out. I was playing competitively. The collegiate division one is intense. It's tough on the body, tough mentally. You are performing at the highest level. You also are under extreme pressure to perform academically to maintain a certain GPA just to play on the team and by the NCAA. And so I think my last year, I started grad school early while I was still playing tennis competitively in the spring semester. And so it was a part-time job in the morning. It was going to classes. It was a grad assistantship on campus. It was practice and then doing study hall and tutoring other athletes at night. And by the end of that entire rigmarole, I was absolutely burnt out. I don't think I touched a racket for a year following graduation. And I was just absolutely finished. It was incredibly tiring. Didn't touch a racket for a year until I did. And it's that feeling of like, oh, it's such a youthful, playful feeling. And I think it's really interesting how you remember how you got here or what got you here. And that was something that was so, so impactful to me.
Is there anything you think you could have done to avoid that burnout? We've all gone through it, right? When you put in so many hours, so much pressure. Looking back, is there anything you think you could have done, or was it inevitable just given like the circumstances of how much effort you had to put in between being an athlete and a student?
Yeah, I think for me personally, it was inevitable. I had condensed so much of my academic life and career into such a short period. I did my undergrad and grad school in 4.5 years. And that was self-imposed. It was one of those things, oh, I can do it. No one asked me to do it. It's like, I'll do it. I'll raise my hand. So it was definitely a self-imposed burnout. I think it definitely gave me a lot more appreciation for it. But when I did play, it was like, oh, I want to be here. I'm not forced to be here. I can spend as much time or as little time on the court. I really found that love again from when I was a child, and I really, really appreciate that.
Absolutely. And you've had a really successful career post that, right? And been a part of the Atlanta scene. What are you most excited about? Give us some context for the ones that are not like nearby where you are in Atlanta. Like, how is the tech scene there? Like, what gets you excited? Like, who are some up and coming companies that we may not be aware of?
Yes, of course. So I have had the absolute privilege of being part of the Atlanta tech scene from, I would like to say, almost day one. I have really seen the growth of the market explode over the past 6-7 years, maybe even a decade. I moved to Atlanta 10 years ago, almost to the day, to the month. And I have seen so much remarkable change, so much progress, which is incredible. And I joined early, I was the first marketing hire at SalesLoft in 2014, that's when it was, and joined at the offices were at the Atlanta Tech Village. Now, if you're not familiar with the Atlanta Tech Village, maybe you have heard of it, but it is the fourth largest technology hub in the US. Now, that is remarkable considering the hub is outside of Silicon Valley. It's also outside of New York City and Boston. So I think that is truly a remarkable feet for a city that's just up and coming. And this was opened, I think it was 2013 when David Cummings opened the doors. Now, David Cummings was the founder of Pardot. And interestingly enough, Sales Loft was born and started at a small desk inside the Pardot offices back in the day. And the Atlanta Tech Village had seen some unbelievable companies. If you haven't, you're not aware of it, Calendly, which is remarkable, came out of the Atlanta Tech Village. They still have strong roots there. And it's something impressive to see what they built. And it's such a community. It really spearheaded what the Atlanta tech scene is today, and spawned so many other opportunities. So Tech Square Labs came out of that, from that idea of having that tech hub, and so did Switchyards, which is more focused on the B2C side. But if you are a B2B company, it is where you come out of. BitPay as well graduated from the Tech Village, Terminus as well. And I think there's over three, if I'm not mistaken, there's over 300 startups based out of the Tech Village. They've created over, I think it's over 5,000 jobs created. And the last number that I looked at, it was over 800 million was raised from the startups out of the Tech Village. Significant numbers indeed.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the growth in Atlanta is remarkable.
To say the least. And congrats on your decade anniversary. I don't know if that's a term, but we'll coin it here. I actually did not realize the impact that the Tech Village has had. So that's outstanding and remarkable in terms of the overall impact that it's, I'm sure, had not only on Atlanta, but the broader world with some of the innovations that have come out of it. Talk to us a little bit about Sales Loft, right? It's when you started, you were probably like single digit hire or close to it, first marketing hire. And the question like that comes to my mind, right? You had a 3-year successful journey there. And a lot of people that might not be familiar with tech, that's almost frankly double or triple like what I'm seeing become now the standard because there's so much turnover in marketing. What do you think like helped you frankly like have that much of a successful journey at Sales Loft? Like what do you attribute that to?
I attribute that 100% to the team and the culture and the leadership. I had never been part of a team that was so focused on culture in my career, and was truly something that I've taken with me in my career. And I attribute so much to my career from Sales Loft. I am incredibly fortunate to have been part of that rocket ship early days, mind the cliche, in the tech startup world. But the way that the leadership poured into the culture, poured into the day-to-day, is unlike anything I've ever seen. And still to this day, it is a rare occurrence that you see it happen. And I have not been, you know, in the conversational part of it for quite some time, for 3 years now, at Sales Loft. But I think it was most impactful for me. And when I started, it was red. There were most of the original people were still there when I left. I'm not sure if that's the case still today. And it's tough. I will say that going from that so-called family, that word's tossed around in the startup world, very freely, but when you go from that small microcosm of society of just a handful of people, 20 people, that's like your rec league softball team, to 100 even is a tough move. 200 is really a shift now. To 300, 400 is it's really tough to move from being in the 20 people to 400 people. Now, to make that shift, to make that move seamless, it takes a lot. It's impressive. And I think if you can be with a company in the very, very early stages and still be there toward the end or an exit or whatever that may be, I want to know what you're doing, because that is, I don't think people talk about that enough. They don't talk about that shift from 10 to 100 or 10 to 500 employees. And I'm not sure that that secret or that formula has been shared enough, because it's a very different stage in the life cycle of a company, and being able to navigate those waters. Because I know a lot of people are builders. There are a lot of people coming at the early stages. They're scrappy and they thrive in that environment. It's not the same when you bring in outside funding. It's not the same as when you have direction from a board and outside investors and sort of collaboration in that regard. So I think that's really, really interesting to see.
So what was the formula, you think, in this case? And we got to be, we can't assume that it's going to work for every other company, but what mm-hmm. do you think in the case of Sales Loft, like what was that recipe or a couple of things that, like, frankly, really helped them accelerate while being able to maintain their culture?
I think communication from the top down, but also from the bottom up, and being willing to have those candid conversations. It takes an effort. It's a single one thing that a company can do to change the direction of which they're moving, but not many companies choose to invest in it because it is so hard. Company culture is really, really hard. Communication is important, listening, being heard, giving everyone a voice, but not changing your direction or product market fit, making hard decisions along the way. It's tough. I think when you're on such a high growth pattern, bringing in people because you have to have that headcount and be able to get the job done, but still maintaining culture, takes a lot of hard decisions. I'm not saying you're not going to face some bad hires along the way, but it's recognizing that it's very, very important very early on.
Fair enough. What lessons did you learn that, like, besides culture, like tactically, that made you a better marketer at Sales Loft?
I think it's very important to not, and I think I might get quite a bit of backlash here, but this is the kind of marketer that I am, is that I don't believe that everything needs to be measured. Yes, you do need to measure what you're doing to improve upon it, but don't become so caught up in everything that you measure that you lose the art of marketing. What I've seen over the past couple of years is that has been a significant shift to the science of marketing. Let's measure this, let's turn this knob, let's focus on that, where we lose the art of marketing, the understanding, what gets people excited. It becomes that true understanding. There has to be a balance between the art and science of it. But don't get so caught up in the science of it that you're not measuring. And conversely, don't get so caught up in the art of marketing that you're not measuring and just throw it as, it's branding. We're just going to do it for branding. Doesn't work that way. But I was given so much autonomy at SalesOff to try bold things that it really impacted the way I think long-term. And that's the marketer that I am today, is to try bold things, try new things, to try and ruffle the feathers a little bit, to push people beyond what they think is normal, and to keep pushing the envelope beyond and to make it a little bit uncomfortable. But they gave me that autonomy to try and do new things. And I'm forever appreciative of being able to do bold things in a B2B space that it wasn't done. Now you see it everywhere. A lot of people are doing different things. A lot of people are trying things that haven't been done before in the B2B space specifically. But in 2014, no one was doing that.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. It's crazy to see the shift, right, over the last 6-7 years. Mm-hmm. So you've moved on now for 3 years from Sales Loft. What do you do day to day now? I want to give you the opportunity. Like to share kind of what you're working on now, Tammy.
Yeah. So over the past 3 years, I have been working on an agency, 31 South. We have been focusing on a lot of B2B clients as well, focused in a little bit of the same thing that I did at SalesLoft, but really amplifying that into 4 different areas. One being the experiential event side, secondly, the performance side of marketing, the science, the true gritty science, and then video, really amplifying, telling your story, the storytelling aspect of marketing, and then the brand and how you can really amplify your branding. And those have been the four sort of disciplines that we've been focusing on as well. And over the past year, I've been with the New England Free Jacks, part of Major League Rugby. If you didn't already know, there is a professional rugby league in the United States, and this goes down to my South African roots, and it just takes me back. It's fantastic. I love it. I grew up with rugby. It gets me passionate, excited, and I have been working with them very heavily on sort of the sidelines, doing a lot of the reporting on that, and then establishing that go-to-market in the US, understanding who that audience is, and working with them on that. So that has been truly incredible.
That's awesome. I actually did not know that. So you have a combination or the benefit of working with both companies that go after business-to-business audiences as well as business-to-consumer audiences.
Absolutely, yes.
Which is interesting. What do you think, like, business to business marketers can learn from the playbook of business to consumer playbooks and vice versa? Like if you had the opportunity to kind of steal a couple of nuggets from one or the other, like what would those nuggets be?
I think this is so, so important. I'm so glad you asked that, because what I see day in and day out is B2B marketers look at everyone else, not only in their industry, but in their vertical, and also from other B2B companies. Everyone's looking at each other to get ideas and to get inspiration. And I have found most of my inspiration, not from competitors or not from other companies in the B2B space, but from consumer-led companies and also nonprofit companies. I have learned so much about storytelling from nonprofits that I have anywhere else. And I'll tell you that nonprofits have such an important, they have to lead with storytelling. And all too often, B2B companies and marketers from business to business industries go straight to the product. They go straight to the features and the benefits, but they leave out the storytelling. They leave out the impact. They leave out that human connection or that connectivity in a way that comes from deep-seated storytelling. So if you look at a nonprofit, if you look at the UN, if you look at New Story Charity, if you look like the Cooler Project, or you look at some smaller, even if it's state-led nonprofits, look at how much they invest in the stories that they tell, the lives that they touch, okay? So nonprofits look at the lives that they touch. B2B companies think about it as case studies and testimonials slapped on a website. But if you really look at the personification of that and dive into what they're doing, it is really impactful. So not only consumer focus and the people that they're doing, but look at the storytelling from nonprofits and consumers. That is where you'll see the impact.
So taking a little bit of the nuggets of telling a better story of how, whether it's your product or whatever, how mm-hmm. it's impacting the world. So well communicated. I didn't even think about it. So well communicated. What do you think B2C marketers could take from the playbook of B2B marketers? So if we were to reverse
the scale is quite remarkable, and how, especially in software as a service, how you've seen so much of that absolutely scale from marketing. And I think consumer companies, marketing, get away with brand. They're able to say, and I'll flip this, I'll say that they do. B2B marketers do measure everything, and they have a number behind absolutely everything they do. And I think consumer-based teams can really lean on the research behind what they're doing and come forward with better analytics on what they're doing. I think there are a lot of tools out there that B2B companies leverage to measure what they're doing and amplify their performance, instead of just saying, oh, it's brand, it's for the brand. We could do it because we're doing some branding. So I think there's probably an opportunity there to focus on the analytics.
very, very well communicated. Look, Tammy, we can continue on and on, but unfortunately we're heading towards the end of the show. So if I may ask, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way? Tell us a little bit about your consulting services, who can benefit from it, just to give people some context on like who you can help.
Yes, of course. So whether it is a large company with an existing marketing team or early stage company without a team, really coming into each of these areas where we can say, listen, let's give you some new ideas, fresh perspective, a different way of thinking with and invigorate that team you already have. Or from a startup standpoint, how can we amplify and help support that bandwidth issue you might have to help scale quickly? Those are two different areas. I am active on social. I am on LinkedIn. I love to hear from you on LinkedIn and dive into a bit of a conversation there. But also on Twitter, it is local at last on Twitter. And on Instagram, it is Tammy McQueen, but I think you're going to get a lot bit more value on Twitter and LinkedIn from a marketing perspective.
Well, thanks for sharing. And before we say our goodbyes, I do want to do the fireway round, which is where I ask you a quick question and you have 30 seconds to answer. So ready to get started?
Okay, I'm ready.
What do you wish you had known when you had started it out? You can take that however you like, but what's one thing you'd wish when you had started out?
Yeah, I wish I knew that I could ask for help sooner. I didn't ask for help enough earlier on. And that is something that I recommend to many folks that are either starting out as an entrepreneur or joining whatever career that is. It's okay to not have the answer and it's okay to ask for help.
Two part follow-up to that. What made you hesitant about asking for help? And two, what was the turning point? Like what, at least from your experience, helped you recognize?
I thought I needed to know all the answers to be able to appear or seem credible or to be invited into the conversation. But I think there's a point at which your bandwidth is stretched enough, or you get to the point where you are in those meetings where you cannot BS your way around and you have to be able to spend more time thinking on it or have more research behind it to come with the facts to be able to either get funding or to get approval or to be given the go ahead or to absolutely ask for more hires. And I think being able to come forward to the table, not with just a quick answer, but to come substantiated with research is a lot more credible. In that way. And in terms of asking for help, there's a point at which you're either burnt out, you've exhausted your resources, or you just simply don't know how to go forward. And there are people around you in your sphere of influence that have been there, that have had that experience that you can lean on, and you need that. If you're not in an academic setting, or you're not learning, or you're not being a sponge to other ideas, it's really hard to move forward or to grow in your own way.
Very fair. Thanks for sharing. Tell me something that's true that nobody else agrees with you on.
Oh. In from a marketing perspective, let's think.
It could be from any perspective, just to be very clear. It's probably my favorite question to ask because it's a curveball, but it could be from any perspective, however you want to answer that.
I'm not sure how many there aren't that don't believe this, but you absolutely have to stay in the game. It's easy to step out. It's easy to sit on the sidelines and then decide to get back in. It's really, really hard to do that. Stay in the game, as tough as it may be. It's easier to get back into a play than it is sitting on the sidelines. So no matter how tough it is, hang in there, stick it out, and stay in the game.
Well communicated. So push forward and take the breaks if you need to as well. What, looking back, what's your special skill? Like, what's, if I had to ask you, like, what's one unique skill that you have that's helped you get to where you are? What would you say that is for you?
Relationships are 100% the most important thing in business. I have always said yes to taking a coffee. I have said yes to offering my help. I've said yes to pro bono work. And not because I'm looking for something in return down the line, but because I truly value those relationships. And there has been nothing more important to me than building and fostering relationships in business. It's the way I conduct business and will continue to do so. And those relationships are far more important than anything else. And so I will continue and to focus on that and really, really build upon that. So taking time to understand someone, know them at a deeper level, why they're doing business, what they're doing, it has been important to me. And that feeds into the community aspect of it and just really being part of, being a human, just, you know, sending out just blanketed statements doesn't work, or blanketed emails doesn't work for me. It's that human connection that I have leaned upon for many years. I can get better at it, but it's something that I really, really value.
Well, we're very grateful and value the fact that you said yes to this podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, no, thank you so much. I feel honored and privileged to join this community.
Absolutely. It's great to have you. It's been a great episode. Before we say our goodbyes, I always want to give our speakers the opportunity to pay it forward. If there's anyone you want to thank, that could be anybody, feel free to do so, because this is your moment to pay it forward as well.
Yes, you know, for a lot of the mentors that I've had, but more so the champions that really champion my career, Anand Thakkar has been truly remarkable. He's in Atlanta. He is a truly remarkable entrepreneur, coach, just friend, mentor, whatever you want to call it. He has been remarkable. And also Jason Limkin is truly that beacon in the SaaS community and has guided a lot of my inspiration as well for hunkering down and just keeping going.
Yeah, absolutely. Jason's had a profound impact on my career as well as my life. Mm-hmm. So well communicated. Yeah. Again, Tammy, such a pleasure to have you. So thanks so much for joining us and look forward to hopefully seeing you rather sooner than later.
Yes, thank you so, so much.
Bye-bye.
Managers become great leaders. And how do they do that? Well, Plato helps you find the perfect mentor thanks to its network of experienced engineering leaders who work at the world's best tech companies. For a monthly fee, you have unlimited access to mentors who can help when you have challenging situations as a manager. Visit them at PlatoHQ.com.